Welcome back, everyone, and a special welcome to those of you who are joining your first teleclass. You picked a good one. My name is Paul Weber, and today we are really pleased to have Loretta Litz-Fauerbach with us to present the basics of controlling device-related infections. Loretta is the Director of Infection Control at Shands Hospital, which is part of the University of Florida program in Gainesville. She has been an infection control expert for more than 30 years, which, Loretta, I think qualifies you for grande dame status. She has served as an APIC board member. She has chaired the Practice Guidance Committee and Communications Team. In 2007, she was the recipient of the Carol DeMille Achievement Award, which is an award presented annually to a pioneer in the development of the role of infection prevention and control professional. Loretta currently serves, along with her day job, on the Joint Commission Expert Advisory Panel for Consensus Measurement in Hand Hygiene, and she is also the co-leader for the Shea APIC Communications Network. She's been active in research and development of infection prevention and control standards. She's the author of many articles and best practice documents. You only really need to do a search on the web using her name. You'll find some amazing things. It is really an honor to welcome her back for her second teleclass with us. And from Shands Hospital in Gainesville, Florida, Loretta, I turn it over to you.
Thank you very much for inviting me to talk today. I've had a long and exciting career in infection control, and I hope you can learn some things from me today, and that we know that there's so many new things and so many new approaches that are occurring out in the United States as well as international, and we're learning so much more about device-related infections as well as other parameters. What I'd like to do today is talk about some prevention strategies, the bundle approach, because I think that's probably the newest and most exciting thing. When I was starting infection control, everybody talked about, oh, well, you've got to do one thing at a time so you know it works. Learning to build teams and stakeholders and feedback and involving administration all the way down the chain in your organization is also critical, that every person has a role for this. Using some of the technologies that have made it more likely for us to be able to prevent infections, and also identifying key strategies that we can apply across the board. When we look at infections, we know that many of our patients are plagued with us putting and creating more holes in them than what they came with. We know that central lines, ventilator-associated pneumonias, and catheter-associated UTIs have brought about a lot of morbidity and mortality to our patients over the years. And hopefully with some of the newer initiatives being applied, we'll be able to say that these infections are reduced to that irreducible minimum as we strive to learn more and reach zero. One of the other things we found here is that many of other catheters such used for dialysis or even the ventricular assist devices that are put in patients, destination patients, or patients that are waiting for transplantation often can lead to infection if not managed appropriately. And although we won't be talking about them, I cannot not say a few minutes, just because device-associated infections, there's the big three hit, but when you look at your problems and your patients, you need to be aware that there's other devices out there that we need to be considered, ventriculostomies, a whole host. And the problem with looking at device-related infections individually is that there's so many things in common that make them problematic for us. We know that anytime you put something into the human body, the plastics that we have now, the metals, all the devices that we've been able to develop also provide ground for biofilms. And biofilms can provide the wonderful opportunity for bacteria and fungi to sort of set up housekeeping and become very, very happy, and then they can slough off and cause bacteremias, other site-related infections, and basically, until we get the device out, there will be a risk of infection that continues. We know that, if we look at the next slide, that there are many guidelines that have been out there. And the HCPAC guidelines, and one of the sad things about that is they've provided wonderful guidance, but for some reason they didn't take hold. They didn't get accepted because sometimes they told us to do things that cost money, or they told us to do things that cross barriers of, how dare you observe me? You're not a physician. How dare you tell me when to wash hands? You weren't in that room. And until the IHI started at 1 Million Lives campaign, where things were bundled together and they had the right trick. They allowed administrators to rally around the flag and get initiatives going and buying in. One of the cute things that can, that can happen is that a lot of times the administrators did not recognize that the IHI bundles were based on CDC HCPAC guidelines in most cases. They might have added a few newer pieces of information, but I was talking to an administrator one day, and they said, well, I don't care about what CDC says. I want to know what the IHI said. And I had a smile because IHI got their attention, even though these guidelines were in place for many years prior. And then finally, the really nice updated version and simplified version of the SHEA IDSA compendium that was released in October of 2008, where in a nutshell, it provides you known bundles, known approaches, and answers some of the questions that have been researched since the HCPAC guidelines first came out. Now, I always like to get my things around my head. And so what I did was I sat down and I thought, when you look at CVLs, Foleys, and VAPs, there are so many things and processes and the successes that are in common that maybe rather than thinking of them as totally separate, we need to look at device-associated prevention strategies. And so I did my little 12-step plan here. And one is devices must be only used when medically indicated according to established criteria. Number two, devices must be removed when it's no longer clinically indicated. Now, as you see, those are common for all the devices that you can think of. You should implement a bundle with daily evaluation and discussion with the team that's providing care. So often, I just sat in the ICU Improvement Committee this morning where the physician says, I know I should pay attention to the Foley, but until we started rounds and the nurse asking me about that every day and even every shift, I just sort of blanked on it. And so we need to raise that awareness. Checklists will be the name of prevention from now on. Because you cannot, in any situation, remember the exact order, the exact methodology when you're trying to do a procedure. And in reality, it is an aid rather than an insult. So many professionals say, oh, I've done catheters forever. Well, yeah, and we've had infections forever. And one of the things that the Health Protection Group from Scotland has developed, that they've even implemented Foley checklist for people to do and observe. And we haven't gone that far yet in the United States, but I think we're going to have to get there to get to zero. We need to monitor practice, documenting in the chart, and reviewing those monitors to make sure we have compliance. We need to educate healthcare providers again and get return demonstration, because how many times have somebody says, oh, yeah, I know how to do that central line, and then when you stand and watch, their interpretation of a sterile field is not what it should be. Patients and families need to join us in this prevention initiative. They need to understand what they can do and what they shouldn't do. And I always love it when you see somebody trying to put a Foley bag onto their IV pole. That means we haven't educated well, and we need that opportunity to do that. We need to observe and report all critical activities. We need a commitment from our healthcare providers. Again, Health Protection Scotland, in their UTI initiative, implemented a form that says, I will commit to practicing the way we have determined is safe for the patient and do everything I can to make sure that I prevent infections. And I think, you know, it sounds a little hokey sometimes, and it going to a chief of staff saying, you know, we'd like to get everybody to sign off that they are going to commit to doing the right things right may be uncomfortable, but I think raising that awareness and making people accountable, at least in their own minds to start, is the right step. We also know from the studies done at Johns Hopkins and in Michigan that supplies or kits and carts, you know, people want to do the right thing. But if you're in the middle of patient care and you have to gather 12 different pieces to do sterile technique, you probably won't remember everything. Or if you need something else, are you going to break the field and go get it? And so having supplies readily available to do the right things right is critical. Now, you also need outcome surveillance, because I think outcomes monitor and push and drive our edge. You know, you get down to 2 infections and you do some root cause analysis on that and you understand what you're doing or what you're missing, it helps you to improve and go further. It's exciting when you have groups that you can go back to and say, you know, you've had 220 days with no VAPS, a real accomplishment for their hard work. We also need to do process surveillance, because I guarantee you, unless you do the right things right, we will not achieve reduction. And then finally, hand hygiene and proper sterile and or aseptic technique. That's integral for each one of these devices, and I challenge you for any other device, that if you don't do it right and follow the proper protocol, you will end up with an infection. So the existing guidelines, and there's more coming out. You know that ARC has data that's out there that has been very influential. The Health and Human Services just put out a draft on prevention strategies. And finally, the National Patient Safety Goals are addressing device-related infections through central lines. I mean, there's 17 pieces of the National Patient Safety Goal, and everything's important. And so it gives you maybe, you know, one of the things I'm doing is I'm surveying our non-ICU areas that have lines placed and asking them, how do they monitor? Who has trained those folks? Trying to turn up the dial on those practices because of national patient safety goals. Because what we know is that central line-related infections are critical. They cause 400 deaths. They can increase mortality, length of stay, and cost. In this day and age, if you can cost avert expenses by not having infections, your administrator will be very happy with the infection control program. So don't forget in all of that to calculate How many have you prevented? If you started an initiative, where were you and what do you have today? And then do the estimate of how much it costs. So let's turn a little more focused into our device-related infections and look at central lines. Now, there are many risk factors that increase the risk, prolonged catheterization, prolonged hospitalization, heavy microbial count, internal jugular, neutropenia, TPNs, prematurity, standard care not being evaluated. I know one of the things that we looked at was excessive manipulations. And there's also data to show that CVL infections are impacted by a reduced nurse-to-patient ratio. Finally, femoral lines, if they have to be used because it's the only site, you need to get rid of them as soon as possible. The nice thing, being a female, is that if you're a female, you have a reduced rate. Nobody knows why yet, but at least data appears to be that way. So other risk factors. An infection at a remote site, are you going to seed your catheter with a transient bacteremia from a wound infection or from a UTI? Catheterization or colonization with organisms. If you don't handle it right, if you contaminate it as you're going in, and then once they're colonized, the potential for infection exists. We know that they used to believe that IV catheters that were longer than 72 hours, the non-central lines, the peripherals, had to be removed. There's some new data on that. But basically, the longer your catheterization, the more likely you are to have an infection, the more stopcocks, the more lumens, the inexperience of a central line. These are not new. And we know that there are many areas that the infection can occur. It can incur when you're inserting it. If you don't maintain skin antisepsis while you have it or during insertion, you can contaminate the hub. Or on rare accounts, there have been national problems with contaminated infusate or wherever you mix that up, whether your pharmacy does it or whether you're doing it on the unit, the intrinsic contamination can lead to an infection. Now, very early on in the HCPAC, there were five basic steps: clean hands, best insertion site, alcohol, CHG combination. The HCPAC guideline calls for 2% or greater, and it's interesting, in the Shea compendium, they have now 0.5% or greater in an alcohol combination. Chlorhexidine is better than betadine, but if you have a very young infant or someone allergic, which is fairly rare, you do have to use betadine. And if they're allergic to the two above, then alcohol is the best approach. You want to use maximal sterile barrier precautions. And we'll talk a little bit more about that, and removing the catheter as soon as possible. Additional information has come to bear that you need to have a checklist. You need to have, each and every time it's inserted, someone observing it and someone doing the right practice to make sure that each and every time. And that person has to be empowered to stop if they observe a break in technique. I know many new nurses are uncomfortable with that. Many new young doctors, an intern, if it's the attending that would be doing a procedure, may feel inadequate to stop the chief. But it's critically important that the culture in your facility recognize and applauds that kind of stepping up and taking ownership. And in fact, they need to be schooled that if somebody tells you you broke technique, you say, thank you very much, let me start over. Now, one of the things that we've learned from IHI is that you need this in a bundle. These steps must be done all the time and together, and not sporadically. We also need that review of can we get it out. Hand hygiene. You know, Joint Commission is going to be publishing their monograph on hand hygiene and how to measure compliance, but whatever way you choose, it's critical that people understand when and where you need to do it. You may also want to check the WHO website. They have some great posters that provide the when and where's in a very good particular form, so that it's very demonstrative of when you should do that. But hand hygiene is critical for each one of these devices. Waterless hand hygiene, you know, it's very important for folks to understand that this is simpler and dries quickly, and that's a benefit because then you can get your gloves on sooner than not. So when we're looking at subclavian, it's always a challenge because a lot of people say, well, we don't want to use that. We want to save it because we have a dialysis patient, or we prefer a pick. But we do know that in many cases, folks should not head for an IJ vein unless it is clinically the best option that's left. We shouldn't be doing femorals unless it's an emergency, and then that should be replaced as soon as possible when the patient's stabilized. One of the incidences, a lot of people used to say, oh, we're going to use PICCs because that will reduce the risk. And the new compendium has said, no, that does not reduce the risk of having a central line. And so people used to believe that, oh, I can leave that PICC in. It's easy to manage. And no, we still need to talk about getting that out as soon as we possibly can. Supplies are a challenge. You know, everybody wants their own little thing, and everybody wants to have it packed the way they want to do it. And so it's very important that the end user participates in with materials management in designing either kits or the stocking of carts. We'd have liked to have carts in our ICUs, but we, an older ICU setting space-wise, and a cart would not have been very feasible. We would have people tripping over it. So we went to kits that everything came, like two sets of gowns and two masks and two gloves and everything that we needed so that you could have the observer and the patient and the person actually doing the inserting. And we found that that worked. One of the things that's very important is that when you're working, you want to maintain a sterile field, but you also want to reduce the skin flora. And if you have somebody in the ED and they've had trauma, you may need to wash off the site before you even start to do your skin prep. It's not intuitive. People have been taught with betadine to do concentric circles starting in the middle and moving out. And so that as you switch to chlorhexidine, especially the current ones that are marketed, they tell you for the optimal results you should scrub vigorously back and forth, back and forth. And believe it or not, something as simple as that may need a lot of initiative and education. Our MICU charge nurse said to me, Loretta, no matter how many times I'm telling the residents, they don't do it that way. And so we went ahead and we did posters that for optimal results from the bright red and squiggling it back and forth, and then also went ahead and did a grand rounds for all the residents. And the chief of medicine attended that to, again, endorse that this was just not Loretta having, one of her fits, but this was critical for patient care, and that yes, even the old dogs could learn new tricks to improve the outcomes. Maximal barrier precautions. I have the great privilege of working with Sam Rodd when he was at Shands many years ago before he went to MD Anderson, and he has done phenomenal work in learning more about preventing central line infections. And Dr. Radd was the first to publish that maximal barrier precautions was critical, absolutely critical. And that, remember, you're now made to be doing this in an ICU or in a procedure room and not in the OR. And so a lot of our nurses and a lot of our young physicians don't understand sterile technique, and that anybody within 12 inches of the sterile field must also be sterile or you have breached that sterile field. And so having that instruction available, but also having a large drape. It's interesting because companies, when they first switched, they had larger drapes, but they still would leave people not totally covered. And the risk reduction was associated with a drape that covered the entire body. And so that's critical to make sure that when you develop your kit or develop your cart, that your drape is appropriate for the patient. Maximal barrier requires that all of the things that are listed here. And it's always good to remember that whatever you're doing, if you're exchanging over a guide wire because it's not functioning properly, it still has to be done using maximal sterile barrier, that it's not just a once and done. Now, we know that there are some things that people have thought and wanted to try, whether you gave antibiotic prophylaxis, did that reduce it? Did you cut downs? All of these things have been shown to, one, either not impact it, or two, increase the risk. And then finally, the adequate space. Have you ever been in a pod-type, open-form-type ICU, and when you're butted up against the next patient, once you get all your machines available, there's no way you can maintain a 12-inch barrier from the patient to a non-sterile machine. So how are you going to address that? Are you going to cover the machine with sterile drapes, or are you going to move the patient to do that? Work that through with your teams when they are trying to implement and maintain that. Post-care is very important. You don't want the IJ moving up and down. You don't want a patient to be able to accidentally remove it. You want to make sure that you have optimal coverage to keep the bacterial load down and that that catheter will not be moving in and out and introducing skin flora because of that movement. Again, a CHG patch at the site is critical. We were one of the first groups to look at CHG patch in addition to doing CHG prep. And yes, that it does provide additional precautions to use both, and so that's critical. So when you're dealing with children, especially neonates, you need to recognize that CHG patch have some caveats. They can't be used on in neonates less than 7 days old or with a gestational age of 36 weeks or less or somebody that has the new the sensitivity. They've put a blue side on the brand that we use because people were getting them on the wrong side. So the blue side up to heaven, and being a gator, go Gators, you know, we always say that we know that God's a gator because we have blue sky and an orange sun. But that's basketball and football. Anyway, CVL care, you want to make sure that if it's oozing, you may want to put a sterile gauze underneath that instead of a transparent dressing initially, but then switch it once it settles. But you want to replace the dressing any time that it's damp or loosened or after lifting the, you know, if you manipulate it. But in general, with the biopatch and with the transparent dressing, you can leave it 5 to 7 days safely. You don't want to use an antimicrobial ointment because that does not reduce the risk of infections, and it can indeed lead to selection of organisms by that. Now, the nice thing with transparent dressings and the brands, and I apologize, I thought I had removed them, the brand, the CHG dressing that we use, the patch, that it helps to extend the use as well as decrease the infection. And so you want to have all these steps covered in your policy so that the patient's care providers know what to teach them, what to do while they're in the hospital, but also what to do when they're discharged. Okay, you want to make sure you've documented all your information. Now, changing of tubing. You know, I grew up in the era when we were changing tubing every 24 hours for everything and the sites because that there had been a national contamination problem with IV fluids, and that was the way they could solve it until there could be other measures put in place. But we now know that the less manipulation, the less changing of IVs or central line tubing, the less manipulation helps to decrease risk. And the HCPCS guideline for prevention of intravascular infections provides really good guidance in helping you establish your hospital policy for times and dates. You also want to make sure that you disinfect the port. That's critical. So many people tend to forget that. You want to make sure that you have policies and directions in your daily checklist. If somebody gets blood, if somebody has lipids or other medication, when should you change your tubing and what methodology they should use for instilling those products. All of those key components help to make sure that you have a good standard of practice. Now, we tell folks scrub the hub because anytime you go to inject anything, there is a risk of introducing contamination. You can safely do that with 70% alcohol. It is good to work on the tubing and the hubs. It's cheaper, too. Not that the chlorhexidine isn't effective, but if you can do it cheaper and just as effective, scrubbing the hub and making sure you do that appropriately is the real key. Educate the patient, and we've talked about that. They need to know, because if you're increasing pain after they've had it for a day or two, then usually something's wrong. It's either malfunctioning or you may have a line or site infection developing. Okay. The guidelines recommend that after you've done all the other standards and all the other bundles that you may want to look at using an antimicrobial impregnated central line. The best data for that is with the rifampin minocycline catheters, but followed by that, the chlorhexidine and silver impregnated catheters are also appropriate. Currently, there's none of these methodologies that are available and approved in children. Surveillance, feeding back your practices. There are a lot of recommendations, and you can look at NIST or the data from CDC and the HCPCS as well to be able to do device-related days. You want to have the number of central line infections related to the per 1,000 catheter days. You also want to look at perhaps some of your performance indicators to see are you measuring up. One of the really big requirements or important requirements whenever you're doing any device-related structure is, I said, that commitment, that infrastructure that administration is committed to help you. Adequately staff infection prevention control programs, information technology that assists in collecting denominator days. One of the things that we do is that our nursing acuity system was modified so that we could collect central line Foley days and VAP days, as well as umbilical catheter days. And that is generated by the nurses clicking that when they do their daily assessments. We also get information, or the central line, the patient days, from our budget and planning group. And it's always good to go back and validate. We had somebody, when we first started doing this, got Foley catheters and central lines switched. And in our validation of looking at the data, we said, whoa, the NICU does not have central line or Foley catheter days like that. And then the programmer said, oh, I mixed up the column. So it's always good to check that to make sure when you do, especially if you're building your own system, that you know you're having it right. And then also validate that people are using it. You want to have resources for education and as well as the laboratory support to understand that. The practical implementation is where I think infection control has and prevention and control has grown the most. And we still are learning the human factor engineering and adult education and making things simple. And so the checklist, the education of personnel, the establishment of carts and kits with material management all make it better for our patients because it's easier to do the right things right in that environment. So, you know, before insertion, everyone should be educated. Do you have a way of a new person on staff coming that's going to do central lines to assure that they have been educated and had return demonstration for practice? Do you know and do you routinely check on preventive measures and how people are doing those? Have they forgotten something or are they following that? One of the things we do now is with our checklists and with our daily evaluation sheets, that goes into a database in nursing where they trend that, and then it also has related to the reduction of our infection rates. CHG bathing has been known to help to prevent surgical site infections, but more recently, data has shown that bathing ICU patients with chlorhexidine on a daily basis helps to reduce the risk of central line infections. And so that many folks are implementing that, whether they're using wipes or whether they're doing CHG liquid cleaning techniques. Remember, with children younger than 2 months of age, you must use povidone iodine to do that. Moving on, the UTIs, we have the CDC definition of that, and I'll scroll through that. We know that they have greater risk the longer you have a catheter in. You can have within 48 hours, 10 to the fifth, and I'm sorry, that fifth in the translation, to create a bacteriuria. We also know that getting the catheter out is the absolute best way to prevent infection. One of the things that, you know, you may hear early on, people saying, oh, it is just a UTI. Well, I'm sorry, nothing's just, because you can go on and have an bacteremia from that, a gram-negative septic shock reaction from a Foley catheter that's become infected. So it's no longer, oh, it's just a UTI. And we all know that the CMS has declared that they will not pay for the comorbid factor if somebody develops a urinary catheter-associated infection. The IHI bundle that came out in the fall talks about avoiding catheterization, hand hygiene, insertion technique, maintaining them according to guideline, practices to avoid, such as disconnecting, irrigation, and replacing routinely. It's very important, too, to review that daily need for a catheter. So we know that there's so many risk factors for urinary tract infections. And so as we go down through these, it's sometimes good to remind folks, you know, the kinking of the tubing seems so simple, but if you don't let that bladder, the urine flow out of the bladder, it builds up and can indeed increase the risk of infection. Now, this slide's pretty busy, but when we do, we are now looking at every time we have a catheter-associated infection, and our nurses are doing a root cause analysis. And this is a chart that we're trialing, looking at sort of stemming, helping them to do that root cause analysis by giving them key points they need to think about and consider. And hopefully this will make it more streamlined and also help them focus on not only who did it and where it was placed, but are you maintaining it appropriately? Checkpoints for preventing UTIs are, again, a good checklist that you can develop and use along the way. And a 3-day stop program is critical. Again, getting it out means you have a lower risk. Sometimes for incontinence, you know, people say, oh, it's easier, but it's not the right answer. We have to learn to do the right things right for our patients. And so, again, there are many strategies that we need to employ and make sure that everybody understands that. And just because somebody has advanced degrees does not mean they understand it. And so developing checklists, developing fact sheets has been a very helpful tool for us in preventing UTIs. You need to monitor the process as well as the outcome to see what they're doing and if it is succeeding and that if people are compliant. We're moving on to pneumonias, and there are many risks for ventilator-associated pneumonia because when you bypass the built-in protection that we have in our body and go right into the lungs, it creates the opportunity for infections to develop very quickly. Dr. Archibald, who used to work at CDC, is my hospital epidemiologist, and I take these slides from him because he said 2007 when he did this, they're the best of times. You know, we have so many new things. We have so many practices that are improving. People are able to generate more knowledge and share it quicker. But it's also the worst of times right now. It's that infections were increasing and antimicrobial resistance. And so we need to apply, when we're looking at ventilator-associated pneumonia, one of those that has a high risk for untoward events, that we do the right things right. And again, there's strong evidence in some things, and we're learning more about how we can prevent infections. But again, the bundle approach is critical. Now, when we start with the bundle approach, one of the bases that you have to go back to is the CDC 2003 guideline, because if you're doing bad practices handling your tubing, handling your ventilator circuit, you're allowing contaminated hands when you're handling the tubing and passing infection or at least contamination from person to person, you will not, no matter what you do with your bundle, prevent infection. So you need to have that good basis of implementing the Category 1 infections solidly down, and then the bundle approach works. So sterile fluid, you know, people letting things sit at the bedside and using that is not appropriate anymore. The IHI VAP bundle has you have the head of the bed elevated. Now, that sounds really simple, but if you're in a trauma unit in a neurosurgical center of excellence where sometimes you can't put them, raise their head, then you have some challenges and you have to work through them. Holiday cessations, assessing the readiness to extubate, peptic ulcer disease prophylaxis, and DVT prophylaxis are all keys in the IHI bundle. Once again, we need to have viable measurements. And what we found, we've added a few more bundle parts, and again, we are tracking those, and only by raising our compliance to 90% and higher have we seen where we have no VAPs in a cardiac intensive care unit for 220 days, some other places for 6 months, you know. And so it is very important that you do the right things right and be able to feed that back to your staff as well. When we look back to the HCPCS guidelines, there are some things that we need to do. Again, staff education, surveillance, using the right definitions, and not performing routine surveillance cultures on equipment or patients. That is not only a waste of money, it sometimes can lead people to think you have a problem when no problem exists. You know, there are times when there's an epidemiological indication through your data that you may have a common bug or you may have increased infections, and then that targeted approach can be taken. But this former practice of going in every Monday, everybody gets pan-cultured, is not appropriate. Now, when you think of the bundle and you've added some new things, we've gone on what we've done before, but look at oral care, subglottic suctioning, gut decontamination, and there's still some questions about lateral rotation. In fact, there's some, at first they thought that was more effective than it appears to be at this point. Education again. Now, you know, when you start here and thinking you've just got to educate about CVLs, you've got to educate about UTI prevention, and now VAP prevention, you're going to have to use some of the better methodologies of, you know, online demonstration. We happen to have simulation dummies where we can have people go in and do sign-offs on that. But you've got to find creative ways to make sure you keep people doing the right things right and having the right skills they need prior to doing invasive procedures. Also, the patient and the family need to understand the prevention strategies and, you know, somebody walking in and saying, gee, they've been sitting up so high, I want to lower them, is not appropriate. It's also good, again, we measure and then compare how compliant were they were with the risk reduction strategies to, and what do we see with our rates. So, again, the right policies and procedures, ensure that people are kept elevated as much as you can, oral hygiene, non-invasive ventilators, endotracheal tubes and line suctioning, and ICU beds that are going for with a built-in tool. That's, again, you know, being able to have a marker so that you can do that automatically. We know that gamma globulin, rotational beds, and administration of prophylactic antibiotics have not been proven to be as effective as we once thought they were. Again, you need to have a supply access. Do you have the right things right? Are they available? Can they be in a cart, or can they be next to the bedside so that you can do them, not only for the central lines or the UTIs, but also the VAPs? And I think that's one of the critical things that administration can help with in partnering with materials management and the healthcare providers to set up to make sure that there are kits and practices that are available. Root cause analysis, you know, you get down to close to zero and you're not there yet. So what are you doing? Are you missing something? Or is there a new strategy that you can apply to get to zero for prevention of device-related infections? The IHI gives you some really nice tools in looking at adverse event triggers as well as root cause analysis and applying them in work teams in the unit, in each specialty unit, because we have found we have multiple ICUs that are different specialties and have different populations, and in many times they had to look at what they were doing for their unique population to be able to find the right keys for improvement. Administrative support. Health Protection Scotland holds that accountability up very high, that you say what you're going to do and that you're held to be responsible. If you're not doing what you need to do, that somebody steps up and says, you know, you didn't wash your hands, you didn't use sterile gloves, you picked up something off the bed and you shouldn't have. You know, and as well as having administration, and I think this is key, given the good old attaboys. You know, you did it right. We think this is valuable. We're putting it on our board dashboard, and we have three different ICUs that are recommended, that are seen in our board dashboard for as sentinel tracking for VAPs, central lines, and UTIs. And then we also have our pediatric dashboard for our children's hospital that has, again, these measures. So from the very top to the bottom, people need to know what's happening, they need to know what's important, and that the communication occurs bidirectionally. So, you know, how do we get things done? Well, human factor engineering, and there's a whole science out there, we've got to look at this complex system called healthcare and design systems to do things in the most efficient and most predictable manner. We've got to make it easy to be compliant. We need to teach, monitor, and provide feedback on processes and outcomes. If someone doesn't know what they're doing, has had a negative untoward event, put a Foley catheter in the ED and see an infection 2 days later on the nursing unit, somebody needs to communicate that. Conversely, if they're in the OR and somebody's transporting the catheter bag on their stomach to the recovery room, that needs to be communicated. And we need, and I think the most important thing, is that we have a personal commitment from everyone to prevent device-related infections. Now, I've never known anybody to enter healthcare and say, gee, I don't care, I'm going to do what I want. But I sometimes think in our busy, busy world, in our world where we have so many priorities, that we need to take that break and have our healthcare providers stop and think that their actions and their commitment to doing right things right will improve the lives of their patients. So, references are there. The APIC guide has some really good information. The Joint Commission website has some information that can help you. IHI has multiple tools and bundle information, the Health Protection Scotland, the CDC, and the SHAE-APIC Compendium. So hopefully you'll be able to access these and learn how to better prevent infections for our patients and to improve the outcome and truly be infection preventionists.
Loretta, thank you very much. Looking at how many slides you had, I was skeptical that you'd be able to bring it in the time allowed, but you did a capital job and left a lot of additional reading for us with a lot of good points, and your references really are tremendous. Is there one defining document for preventing device-related infections that everybody needs to have in their library?
Well, it's hard to say, but I have found some of the different ahas at Health Prevention Scotland. It was first mentioned in one of the UTI prevention documents that came out. And what I liked about them is that they gave you some really good tools. They talked about how to monitor, how to hold accountability, and what to do with some good examples. But I think also IHI has some good examples, because I think, you know, most of us that have done infection prevention for a while, or even just getting in it from what other position we had before, we've gotten down some of the basic knowledge. But I think how to get it, how to teach people how to get that commitment to making sure everybody does the right things right all the time is where we're going to make the best achievement.
Well, if you can find a way to make sure that everyone does the right thing right all the time, then you are certainly going to be a very wealthy lady.
Oh, yeah, well, you know. it's interesting because I think success breeds success.
Mm.
And I just worked with our ICU Improvement Committee, and, you know, there's times when they would grill me, like, are you sure, you know, or this and that. And the doing the process monitors, which they fought, and the surveillance data simultaneously, they have finally recognized that it goes hand in hand. And I think that's the key, that you get process and outcomes, and that they can see where the, when things aren't going right and things aren't being done, that it does have untoward effect on our patients.
Yeah. Thank you very, very much for that. I just have a couple of comments before we close. Firstly, there were a couple of product brands mentioned in the slides, and folks should know that the Teleclass Education Program doesn't endorse or advertise.
Yeah. And I tried to remove those all, and I realized that I left them.
Left a couple in there. That's okay. Thank you to all of you for joining us today. And Loretta, thank you especially. I know this is a very, very busy time for you, and you made time to spend with us today. So thank you for a tremendous presentation.
Well, thank you very much.
And so, everyone, we will talk again very soon. Goodbye.